Good afternoon, and thanks for the lunch from Nautel. That was delicious. I'd like to introduce Nick Pollan, who is VP of RF Engineering for Electronics Research and a registered professional engineer. Nick has also worked in multiple areas of ERI, including engineering and design of FM and TV antennas, plus channel combiners for FM and TV applications. He spent the peak years of the deep TV transition working at ERI's Gray Main manufacturing facility, producing TV filters and multiplexer systems. Nick currently leads the RF engineering group of ERI and has been instrumental in introducing new products such as ERI's shared aperture FM antenna, low power FM and TV filters. Nick graduated from Purdue University and joined ERI shortly after. He is a member of the IEEE and AFCCE.
Thank you, John. So I'll talk a little bit today about some FMT and manifold combiner designs, but I'm also going to go over some of the other types of combining for FM systems, constant impedance combiners. So first, why do we need bandpass filters? Just a quick overview. So bandpass filters provide separation from other frequencies, other channels, the transmitters, and primarily so that we can comply with the FCC regulations for intermodulation products. They're used in multiple station combining, so we can put multiple transmitters onto the same antenna system and reduce the amount of equipment that's required for broadcasters. So down to the basics. So bandpass filters are inherently narrowband devices. They're not broadband like antennas. We're trying to keep things tight so that only one channel can get through. That means they have an exceptionally high quality factor. And when it comes to the quality factor, the higher your Q, the better your selectivity, the lower your insertion loss. And of course, bandwidth plays a big role into that too. For FM, 2, 3, or 4 pole designs are pretty common. There's even some 5 poles out there. Bandpass filters are composed of tanks. So if you've ever heard of a tank circuit, the tank consists of resonators, one resonator and loops. The resonator controls the frequency of the filter, whereas the loops control how much energy is coupled into that resonator. So when you look at a return loss trace on a network analyzer, each tank is gonna contribute one pole or one notch in the return loss response. So that's very quickly looking at a measurement, you can see how many tanks or how many poles the filter is. So at the top of the chart on insertion loss, if it's 0 dB, that's perfect efficiency. We never see that. These charts are generally on the network analyzer are represented in dB, which is a logarithmic scale. So every 10 dB down is 10 times less power than the previous iteration. And the formula for converting dB into efficiency is shown there too. So bandpass filters are, because they're narrow, they're generally used for in-band applications. So if you're trying to isolate, like I said, one channel in the FM band from another channel in the FM band, you would use a bandpass filter. This is actual measured data from a bandpass filter. I can't remember if it's a 3 or 4 pole, but you can see the higher in frequency you go, you start to lose isolation. They don't work well, really from third harmonic up. If you think about the physical characteristics of a resonator, in current technology, the resonator is 1/4 wavelength. So every half a wavelength from 1/4 wavelength, it will resonate again. So at the third harmonic, that would look like a 3/4 wavelength cavity, and it would resonate there, and you wouldn't have predictable isolation. So bandpass filters are generally, you know, they're really good in band, so like in the FM band, and they're usually pretty good at attenuating a second harmonic, depending on how the bandpass filter is constructed. There are some techniques that aren't as good at second harmonics than others. But generally speaking, anything from second harmonic down, bandpass filters do very well. Anything above, like anything above second harmonic, you would need a low pass filter and use those together. So the construction, I talked about the loops a little bit. And because I'm from ERI, I only have pictures of ERI products. So our filters, especially our higher power filters, are loop coupled. So this is a picture of one of those loops. You can see the tank has been removed, so you can kind of see how it operates inside the cavity. It bolts to what we call a dog bone, and it just bolts down. And then the loop can rotate inside the cavity to change how much energy is being coupled to the resonator. Some other types you may see, some of our smaller filters or other manufacturers, space coupling is quite common in television filters, capacitively coupled filters. You know, the loop I've got shown here is an inductively coupled filter because the loop is grounded on both ends, so it's an inductor. A capacitively coupled filter, it'd be like a floating piece of metal in there, where it would be a voltage coupling rather than a current coupling. A grounded inductive coupling conducts, you know, by means of current, whereas a capacitive coupling would couple by means of voltage. And then the other type is a direct tap coupled, which those generally aren't in FM filters at all. Those are very strong couplings. In VHF filters, high band VHF filters, direct tap couplings are pretty common. That's where the loop comes in and it physically connects to the first resonator. So those are the strongest couplings. Capacitive couplings would be the weakest couplings, and then inductive couplings, like this loop I've got shown here, are kind of in between. So depending on how much coupling we need to get the filter response we want would usually determine which coupling style we want to use in the filter construction. So current technology, almost everyone uses Invar rod now for temperature compensation. It's an iron nickel alloy. It's got a very low coefficient of linear thermal expansion. And you can see there I've got the bellows shown on the end of an ERI resonator that handles the expansion of the material. So on the previous slide, you might have seen how the resonator is attached to the base plate of the filter. So that is a physically solid space. So if we call that like our reference plane. So when metal heats up, it tends to grow and expand. So what happens in this filter here is the copper, which there's about 30 inches of copper that goes down to this bellows, it will expand as the filters get warm. And the filters are going to get warm because filters are inherently lossy and they generate heat. So the copper will expand into that bellows, and then the Invar rod that runs through the center of the resonator will control the absolute location of that corona ball at the end of the resonator, so the physical length of the resonator won't change over temperature. And that's pretty common to most manufacturers. ERI uses the bellows, other manufacturers will use finger stock. At the end of the day, it's pretty much the same approach among all current designs. Some older designs, some of you may still have. ERI used to use a bimetallic coil in their filters to help temperature compensate. And one of my favorites was actually an Andy Alford filter I got to take apart, I don't know, 10 years ago now. I think it was in the Hancock building. But it was a 60-inch long cavity. And they didn't use Invar in those days. So it was a half wavelength cavity. It was beautifully machined on each end. I couldn't believe that they would have done that. I don't know how they would have done that. Very large lathe, I assume. But the resonator was blended in to the end plates. And then they had control rods that went the entire length of the cavity, that as the cavity expanded with heat, because they had the same problems we have, there was a mechanical actuator on the inside of the cavity that would move a small piece of metal closer to the resonator to temperature compensate it. So it was just a really neat design. That's the only one I've ever seen, and I don't know if any of them are still in service or not. I kind of doubt it, but. So the types of combiners, we got reflective filters. They're all made up of reflective filters. And when I say a reflective filter, that means the transmitter would see the actual return loss of the filter. So if you hook the transmitter directly to a three-pole filter, it would be transmitter, usually a low-pass filter, then a band-pass filter, and then out to the antenna. So those are all used with reflective filter types. We got T combiners, branch combiners, dark point combiners, and manifold combiners. And basically, they're all basically the same type of combiner, just a slightly different arrangement. The advantages to those, they're lower cost overall because it's one filter per station. The disadvantages is that there's usually additional engineering that's required if you want to expand it. Constant impedance combining, it uses two reflective filters, so it's each station would have two filters between two hybrids. So you've doubled your filter count and you've added two hybrids, so obviously that's added cost. The advantage is future expansion is very easy because you've got a wideband port that you can just plug another transmitter into. And of course the disadvantage is the physical size and cost because there's just twice as much hardware to deal with. There's a rendering of a constant impedance combiner. Like I said, the two filters are in parallel. The hybrids split the power 50-50, so you split the power load between the two filters so you can increase the power handling of the combining module by double. So sometimes I use the term directionality with constant impedance filters. You have an input port and it comes out one output port, even though the wideband port is physically connected to one of the filters. It's if you put an ohm meter on it, you would get a dead short because it's all shorted together. But because of how RF works and the wavelengths, when we put power into the input port, it only comes out the one port. So it has a sense of directionality. The power goes one way. These also have, high power handling compared to single filters, and they usually include resistive loads. The benefit of constant impedance filters is if your transmitter is putting out spurious emissions or harmonics that get to this point, a lot of those could be reflected off of your filters and absorbed into a resistive load, so it wouldn't go back to your transmitter to create more issues. So constant impedance filters are, we're one of the few companies that will vertically rack these. Help save space as long as there's ceiling height available. And the modular design of, makes it so that we can vertically rack these, and also in places like the Empire State Building or any building really, it makes it easy to take these into an elevator real easy, just piece by piece, and then we just rebuild them in place. So size becomes less of an issue for us. Just got some, these are floor mount racked, so we're able to save some space in between the filters to help save with floor space. This is actually the Empire State Building. This is their AUX system. We built this completely in our lab. This is their 19 station combiner that we did for them. It's two chains, one 9 station and one 10 station. And then it's fed into an antenna that's got two inputs. So T combiners. So two filters share a common point. So you got a three-pole filter and a three-pole filter. Each station has their own filter. And then at the output of the filter, you have just a simple T. It's just copper that's connected to each other. They're really simple, but because there's no directionality involved with a T combiner, the line lengths become critical so that when the one transmitter hits a short circuit it'll come back and it phases properly to go to the antenna. So you can see there that those are 2-3 pole filters, and it's got a T, and it's just direct connection. Each, I don't know if this has a laser pointer on it. Yeah. So this line length here is critical for this filter, and this line length here is critical for this channel, so that whenever the reflected power comes off of this filter, off the filter skirts, it comes back and it combines to the output. And here's a good place to explain the directionality. So when this, if you just put power on the input of this filter here, that power comes out, and because you basically have a two-way split, right? So you got a transmission line that comes out to the antenna, but you also have transmission line that goes over to this other filter. There's nothing to direct that power just simply to the output. Once that power comes out, it's everywhere in there. So when we design T-combiners, you have to consider how many stations and how much power and how much voltage is becoming a bigger deal, is going to be present on the output side of this manifold or T-combiner to make sure that the line size can handle everything that all the filters are doing. In a constant impedance filter, you could potentially have a low power filter that comes out, say, with an inch and five eighths output. Say it's a 5 kilowatt transmitter. You could plug that into a wideband port of a 50 kilowatt FM station, and that 50 kilowatts would never go to the wideband port for that smaller station. Whereas on this one here, you would have to size both filters the same, essentially, in order to handle the 50 plus the 5. So I don't like to do these. These are complicated to design, simply because, again, these line lengths up here are critical, and they don't always line up exactly right. So we have to take extra effort on, you know, where the elevation is for the two filters to make sure everything can plumb in together, and then designing the rack to hold it all. Two stations isn't too bad, but you go any more than that and it gets complicated quick. So with a manifold combiner, it's just more than two, really. All the filters plug into a common manifold or a T network on the outside. All the line sections are critical lengths. So in essence, there's one T and one filter for each frequency added. And this is just a simple circuit diagram. And you can use these were ideal filters that I plugged in, and I can change all the lengths to get it to tune up. This is a rendering of another filter we had done. This is actually a three station manifold that's actually feeding a constant impedance module. So we tried to fold this one up as tight as possible. Floor space always seems to be at a premium. Just another example of this one's a four station manifold into a constant impedance filter. It's a lot of copper. I'm not sure what that would cost these days. So some of the challenges, I mentioned voltage earlier. So digital modulation has higher peak to average power ratios than analog only. So when everything was analog only, the voltages were, you know, even though the powers were big, the voltages were not all that big. But with digital modulation, IBOC is at, we use 6 dB peak to average ratio. So the voltages start going up. And once you get up so high, it's even worse at television because with ATSC3, it's 10 dB. So 6 dB sounds easy in comparison. But these are just, you know, average power ratings of just the transmission line. So we consider what we need for the transmission line at the output of the filter, and you know we just can, you know, we add everything up and compare it to our standard charts. So here's an example. So we got five stations. So let's say each of them are 5 kilowatts each with minus 10 dBc IBOC. So you can see the analog component at 707 volts, and the digital power is only 500 watts because it's minus 10 from 5,000 watts, and it's adding 447 volts, which is over half of what the analog is adding. So it really is quite the adder. It compounds pretty quickly. So the voltage total would be about 1,100 watts. So we can see here that an inch and 5/8 filter, input filter, that would be an appropriate choice, you know, for a port size for this size transmitter. But if we take that and now we want to, we're choosing, what did I do here? Five stations. So now we take the power for the five stations, and now we have a total power output of 27.5 kilowatts. Our voltage is now 5,700 volts. We need at least a 3/8 inch output for all of these, just based on power. And voltage still sneaks under. The voltage would be 5,700 volts. 3/8 inch transmission line is 6,600 volts. So you can see we're already starting to approach the limits of 3-inch transmission line. And for 3-inch transmission line, now we need to, we're not just talking about inch and 5/8 inputs anymore. We need to pick a filter size that can handle the full output power of the system. So we need at least 3-inch outputs on the filters. So in this case, we would do a 780 with fans or 783 without fans. So this is a little bit of the magic behind the madness, I guess. So we got, this is just a ideal lumped element filter. You see there's four tank circuits here. We've got inductors here to represent the loops. And on this one here, we've got cross coupling. So we've got another inductive coupling connecting resonators 1 and 4, and that presents the two zeros in our transmission line, or our transmission response. Most, not all, but most filters will use an inductive coupling here. And television will use both, just depending on which resonators that need to be coupled together. Some resonators will, once you get into the circuit topologies, you need to use inductive in some cases, and you have to use capacitive in others. But on this, on FMs, it's usually just an inductive coupling here. And then we can, you know, we can use these ideal circuits and we can check it out in a circuit simulator and see what things are actually going to look like, or ideally what they would look like anyways. So the ideal circuits are, you know, you can evaluate things for practicality, you can see what the performance might look like. You can check the return losses, the port-to-port isolations. You can get your group delays to see if it's all within reasonable parameters. It creates a good starting point for a final design, but some of the cons are that lumped elements aren't ideal. The larger the filter gets, the more complex the parameters are, so the further they deviate from the ideal conditions. So when we're, because they are different than ideal components, the transmission line lengths that we've selected in the lumped element model probably aren't going to work. I mean, the relationship is there, but we can't build off of it, which is really, you know, as a manufacturer, that's our goal, is we want something we can build. So a few years ago, I started writing this program, and there's a little bit of calculus behind the programming, but we can choose whatever filter. I've gone through all of our FM filters and characterized them so that we can just pull them out of a menu, change the frequency, and they've been characterized to look like real filters. So we can go in there and we can just change these line lengths, tune it in. You know, changing that length was changing this frequency, which was that first one, each. So in the first two modules, this length, these two lengths really affected this frequency, and this length affected this frequency. And now that we added this new station on here, this length is going to affect those two. And this length between these two modules will affect this one. And we can just start building it up. And you know, we've been using this for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now. And I think there was only one case where I had to go back and figure out what went wrong. But otherwise, we just, I run this and I just, we just build it. We draw it up and we just build it. So, but you can see, you know, I've got other features up here. You can see the insertion losses and the isolations, group delays and all that. But yeah, so I took these numbers and I put them, physical transmission lines combined, input loop designs. Yep, and I've already, the ideal circuit needs to be conditioned differently. So I took those numbers and I made a 3D model just to compare them, and you can see it came out pretty close. And as long as you get into a certain range, you know, as long as the filters come out, like return loss is 20 dB or so, you can just tune the rest out. And it really makes the process go fast. We can keep lead times under control. The 3D model does make it nice where you can visualize the layout before we build something. But this takes time because you've got to tune each filter and then optimize each line. It just takes a lot of time to do something, the 3D model like that. Whereas the pull it out of a Dropbox, you know, approach, it takes 2 minutes. So some of the system considerations, when you would choose a manifold or a T-combiner over a constant impedance filter, and I'm going to be plenty fine on time, I believe. When space is a premium, you would use a T-combiner or a manifold. If the transmitters use tubes, which I know they're starting to fade out now, but tubes and reflective filters didn't always get along. You had to have that phasing section that you threw in there if things started crashing. The output line size and the filter size align appropriately for the manifold. So this is another case. You might, if you have co-located arrays, you could use T-combiners or reflective filters. You'll have isolation between the two antennas, which helps. Arrays typically have 10 feet or more physical separation, so depending on the size of the array, you could have anywhere from 25 to 40 dB isolation between the two arrays. And any changes in, you know, the first system won't affect the second system at all, right? You'll, the isolation will mostly be there. It's not going to, you know, I can't imagine you have icing on one antenna but not the other, but if icing degrades the performance of one system, your isolation between the two arrays is still going to be there. So manifolds and reflective filters would work just fine in that situation. In dual input panels with a manifold, I am less excited about this approach, if I put it that way. So you have an antenna that has two inputs. They share the same elements, so icing would have an effect on the antenna as a whole, so you can lose isolation very easily. And if you did lose isolation, let's say you have power coming up here to this in this port here, it comes up to the antenna, you lose isolation to this chain. Now you have all that power coming down this transmission line, but there's nowhere for it to go. It's got four short circuits down here. It's going to reflect off these filters, and it's going to go right back up. And say this is the right-hand circular polarized portion of the antenna. This is the left-hand. Now you're rebroadcasting that lost isolation into the opposite polarization, and you could potentially create self-interference, which is why I'm not totally excited about that approach. But again, your mileage may vary. It just kind of depends on the situation. So a dual input, this would be my preferred approach for dual inputs. The isolation is less of an issue. Any coupled energy would come down and go into this load resistor. It just gets absorbed as heat, and you don't have to worry about any kind of self-interference. So in summary, the T and the manifolds are lower costs, smaller footprints. The negative, you know, everything has to go in the same spot. You know, you gotta have the floor space for the whole combiner. That's not usually a problem, but it can be in some cases. I've seen some sites where each transmitter room has their filter in their room. A manifold combiner would not work for that. They're not as easy to expand later. You know, like I showed you earlier, you know, the line sections can change. You would need new parts. They are harder to rack, like I said, and the short circuits can reflect the unwanted energy in dual input systems. The pros of the constant impedance systems, they absorb the unwanted RF into loads. They can be placed into different rooms. They're very easy to rack. They have a better synergy with dual input systems. Of course, they are higher cost. They do take more floor space, but they can be placed anywhere. So you can have 50 feet of line between modules or 5 feet of line between modules. It doesn't matter. So if you have get a single input system, use a manifold or a constant impedance, whatever fits the what you want to do better. It doesn't matter. Dual inputs, I would use constant impedance. And then if you're co-located, you get by with a manifold or a constant impedance. And that's all I've got. So if you've got any questions, I'll take them. Or okay, well, thank you.
Well, our next presenter really does not need an introduction. I'll do one anyway, because he's my friend. Jeff Welton has worked with Nautel for more than 30 years, more like 80. He is currently the Nautel sales manager for the US Central Region. He spent 16 and a half years as a Nautel customer service technician, was involved in the 2015 MA3 field tests with the NEB labs, and has performed hundreds of transmitter site visits and field calls. Jeff has been recognized with the 2020 NAB Radio Engineering Achievement Award, the 2019 APRE Engineering Achievement Award, and the 2018 SBE Educator of the Year Award. He's also contributed to the most recent edition of the NAB Engineering Handbook, including authoring the chapter on facility grounding, and performs several presentations a year on topics relevant to broadcast engineering. So without further ado, my good friend, Jeff Welton.
You do the elbow bump. So I came back from Mississippi last week with COVID, which is not part of the presentation, thank God. But I got to give this presentation down there for a grand total of about, I think there were six people in the audience. So we're doing better today already. Ooh, they gave me a fancy new clicker, too. And somebody started the clock. Oh, look, I'm running over into the last. We got extra time. So has anybody here seen me talk about grounding before? None of you? Anybody heard me talk about transmitter site cooling before? This is going to be a rerun for a lot of y'all. But we're going to have some fun with it. I made them get me the headset mic because, you know me, I can't stand still, so I'm not even going to pretend to try. I don't know where I need to point this thing to make it work. Okay, what you call the, there we go. If I hold it this way, it's the down arrow. Gotcha. So we are going to talk about the lightning protection, about the air handling. Hardening the site more and more and more, we're running into physical access and security situations. How many people have had copper stolen from a site? How many people have had copper stolen from the same site more than once? It gets pricey. So a couple of things I discovered. One thing that's not in here, I discovered from a broadcaster in Vermont that barbed wire is an acceptable ground radial for an AM. I've discovered that if you pave over the near field around the base of the tower, it gets a whole lot harder to pull out the ground system. And if you tar copper strap, it gets a lot less value. Those are the three big takeaways from that. But that's the kind of thing. IT security. Is Ben in here? Ben Marth? No? Okay. I was joking at him earlier. Here's the thing. Is anybody here familiar with Shodan? If you don't know Shodan.io, you need to write that down, because if you do anything that you take away from this, and we'll get on it in a lot more detail later. But at this point in the game, I should not be able to access a Nautel transmitter running a default username and password on the public internet. This morning I did. I should not be able to access a Gates Air Max EVA UHF TV transmitter. I won't say that I did because that would be wrong. But there's one in Miami. I shouldn't be able to access 608 Barrex codecs or a whole bunch of Comrex or Tylines or pick your brand of choice. This stuff should not be visible online, but a lot of it is. We need to get better at that. The problem is that I'm preaching to the choir. Y'all are already doing the right things, or you wouldn't be sitting here learning more. It's the people that don't do these things we need to get to somehow. And every time it happens, every single time, there'll be a flurry of press releases and articles in Radio World and on the Broadcast Engineers Forum and on the I Take Pictures of Transmitter Sites. And every time it's like it's a brand new, oh my God, my barracks got hacked. Uh-huh. Now we've improved. This morning there were 608 barracks units visible online. When I first wrote this paper about 8 years ago, there were over 2,800. So yay us, I guess. Okay, so why do I keep pushing this talk? Why do I keep coming here talking about the same thing? This is the reason. How many SBE members in the room? Awesome, keep it up. Anybody who's not an SBE member should think about it. There's various reasons. I'm on the board of directors, so I'm biased, so I won't turn it into an SBE commercial. But there are many benefits. One of the things, their annual salary survey for everybody who fills it out is a huge data pool. So as of 2024, this is the average age of the broadcast engineer. Do you know that almost 20% of broadcast engineers right now are 66 or older? Think about that for a second. At an age when most people are thinking about retiring, 20% of us are still out there kicking it every day. Rock and roll. But that number is increased a lot over the last 20 years. And if it keeps going that way, it's not going to be a viable industry. So we need to fix that. All right. So grounding, and I'm not going to do in-depth grounding presentation. Like I said, half of you or more have heard me say that. I can point you to 15 different places where you can get that information. But I did this talk for the Alabama broadcasters about 4 hours ago. Turns out that, by the way, the Wi-Fi in my room is not good enough to support a Zoom call. My Max Connect couldn't get enough cell phone signal on the carrier it was running to support a cell phone call, a Max Connect backup. My personal, or my work iPhone on AT&T couldn't get enough signal to work as a hotspot. My personal phone, working on T-Mobile, saved the day. Three levels of backup to get the job done. Okay, belt, braces, suspenders, and staple your pants to your hips. Okay, and with grounding, we go the other way. Sometimes the minimalist approach is better. You can have, and Pat and I have had this discussion, you can have too many grounds. It happens a lot, especially if you've got an old site that has evolved. You know, this transmitter got replaced with this transmitter, so you ran a new strap from over there, and this strap got ran to over there, and this one got cut, and we're not sure where it goes anymore. Grounding, I'll give you an example, plumbing. I'm dealing with this at home right now. So my upstairs, my house was built originally in my neck of the woods. A lot of times they'd build a basement and live in the basement while they could afford to build the rest of the house over top. It's not uncommon, even in this part of the world. Well, when they built the basement, they dug a septic system for it and plumbed it into the basement. When they built the upstairs, they dug a new septic system, put in a proper drain field, did it all right, and plumbed the upstairs into that, but left the downstairs into the original. At some point, somebody, who shall remain nameless but wasn't me, plumbed the upstairs kitchen and laundry room into a drain field going out the side of the lawn into a marsh beside the house. Which is fine until the building inspector sees it. And then at some point, somebody else plumbed that into the downstairs septic, which then got plugged. And at this point, I've got two septic systems and a drain field and no idea what's connected to what until it all backed up about 6 months ago and I had to go through and map the whole thing. By the way, you can also get a borescope, video borescope, with a 50-foot cable from Amazon for about $100. I mention that because it is also a really cool thing for looking down in that transmitter that you can't get into to figure out where that bolt went that you just dropped. Okay, it is arguably one of the coolest toys I have in the toolkit right now. So video borescope, some of them are better at a couple of feet than others, but just a little tool recommendation. Okay, so reference ground points. And what I've got drawn here is an example. If you had like a studio facility, you might have a ground in each room. Or if you've got a network TOC, you've got maybe a ground established for each rack. Then tie them all together to a common ground. Tie that to the building reference ground. What you don't do is daisy chain this thing to that thing to that thing to that thing to that thing, and then run them to ground, because you create paths for circulating currents, you lose control of where the lightning energy goes. So short, straight runs. And the big thing, the big takeaway from this is we are playing a current divider game. We are shoving several thousand amps or tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands in some cases, amps of current down a tower to ground. Okay, that energy is looking for a place to dissipate. Ground has a resistance per foot, so if you don't have a pile of copper in there to provide a low impedance path, eventually you're going to see, what happens when you run a lot of current through a resistance, right? If I run 100,000 amps through earth, which has, say, an ohm per foot, that's 2 ohms. What's 100,000 times 2? 200,000. That's a lot of volts. That's why they tell you when you're in the field in a lightning storm, put your feet together and bend down and kiss your ass goodbye, but that's a whole different discussion. So we got to deal with this current divider. So we want the current to go in the places. By the way, some of you are going to recognize a few of these pictures. That one on the left, I am fairly certain, is Sears Tower, whatever they call it this week. Sears. Anyway, that's FMT, WFMT. That's Gordon's old site. But surge protection is critical, like a AC line protector. I think I've got a picture. We'll skip past those two for a couple. Oh, now let's go back to the horse stories. So this one, and I've used this one for years, and he's gone now, so I'm still not going to call him out by name, and I never did then either, although some of his folks have come and said, hey, we fixed that. I did this in Missouri. This was a site in Springfield, Missouri. And one of the engineers said, I remember when you were there, we fixed that, you know. And I said, good, send me the pictures. And he did. Not germane to this discussion, so they're not here, but I will, in my lightning protection, put the after pictures. If you have to cut the base plate from the building frame away to get to the ground rod, probably not a ground rod. This is the J-bolt that holds the building onto the concrete pad. Okay. In a mythical perfect world, concrete does have some conductivity, so it acts as a sort of ground, but not a good ground. And remember that whole current divider. Here's the thing to think about for reference, and I'll get to it again in a bit. A 2-gauge wire has a pretty low resistance per foot. A 4-inch strap has less than half of that resistance per foot, which means that I can run double the current through that same 4-inch strap and have the same voltage built across, okay? E equals I times R. This is all we're doing. Again, current divider. Point being that I want my net resistance on the path I want the lightning energy to follow to be as low as physically possible. The resistance on the path I don't want it to go is going to be as high as I can make it. And that's where things like ferrites, because, yeah, I'm going to talk about them at least once. And anybody here got a J1000, one of our little 1 kilowatt AMs? Get the surge box with it? A couple did. So you remember with the J1000, when you get the surge box, you get this coil of wire, 50-foot length of coax with a connector on it. And the instructions say, don't cut this cable. Use the whole 50 feet, even if it's only 5 feet run. You just leave the rest coiled up. The purpose for that is that the extra wire adds resistance, because the transmitter is the path we don't want the lightning energy going down. So a little extra coax is a good thing. The water bottle filling stations here are the coolest thing ever. That was why I told you about the COVID earlier. So if I start to choke to death up here, you'll understand that I'm not going to die in front of you, I hope. All right. Everybody's seen this picture at least once. When you're doing your grounding, make sure you're connecting to ground. So the guy on the left, or the one on the left site in, I think it was in Indiana, but the engineer was the owner, was the salesperson, was the, it's a one-man shop. Really nice guy. And excellent person. He was putting in this new transmitter, and a buddy of his said, if you don't have a ground rod in a pinch, a cold water pipe will do for a ground. Forgot to mention, it had to be a conductive cold water pipe. So he strapped the ground onto the onto the PVC cold water pipe and called it a good day. And then called us when it blew up, because surprisingly to absolutely no one except him, it did blow up. The one on the right is a station owner brazing a strap onto a ground rod because it came loose, because he'd used a clamp connection. I believe I've told you what I think about clamp connections before, too. Okay? Back to Springfield, that was a ground rod driven at a 60-degree angle, not straight into the earth. It didn't even get through the gravel to get to the earth. Ideally, your ground will get into the water, the ground reference, whatever you use, whether it's a ground rod, whether it's a chem rod, I don't care. Ideally, it'll get into the water table. Now, where I live, we're coming, hopefully coming out of the driest spell we've had since we measured records. Okay, we've had half an inch of rain in 3 months. My water table is several hundred feet down right now. Fortunately, my well is 400, so there's a good chance it'll live through it. But yeah, ideally you'll get into the water table. If you're driving at an angle like this, you're not going to get there. So straight down. Exothermic connections, whenever you can. CAD weld, braze, silver solder, silfos. Do not hose clamp a piece of soft-drawn 6-gauge wire, hey, I'm ground radial, onto the base of your galvanized steel tower and assume it will qualify as a ground. Do not twist the ground lead from your mains to the wire from your ground rod and not solder them in any way, shape, or form at all and assume it'll do as a ground. Okay? Site in West Virginia. For reference, in the first 10 years he owned that transmitter, and it's one of ours, he spent, paid about $45,000 for the particular transmitter. In the first 10 years he owned it, he spent $20,000 on parts, not counting engineering time. And he called and said, I got a lemon. And I said, I'm pretty sure you don't, but I'll be out that way. Let's take a look. So tower is on the south side of the building. It's got this one saddle clamp with the 6-gauge soft ground wire, hose clamped onto a ground rod right beside the tower. Okay. The AC ground is on the northeast side of the building, and it's just physically two pieces of wire twisted together, hose clamped to another ground rod. The transmitter ground, which I didn't show, is another 6-gauge wire going out and hose clamped to a third ground rod in the northwest corner of the building. None of these ground rods are tied together. So they have no connection between them, all hit different potentials. When lightning hits the tower, the only path, because no surge protector in the building either, that would make it too easy. So the only path for lightning energy to dissipate once ground potential spikes high is through all the switching power supplies and all the RF amplifiers in the transmitter out to the AC lines. We told them to connect the three rods together, bond the actual connections, and put in a surge box. Amazingly enough, that was a year and a half ago. We've had zero parts calls from that station in a year and a half. And I know that transmitter's still there and on the air. So it's the little things. Okay, the surge box is critical. And why the surge box is critical is because every transmitter site in the world, almost every transmitter site in the world, some of the high rises, not so much, but most of the ones sitting out in a field, AC comes in from the road, towers in the backyard. Hang all the stuff you don't want to explode in the middle. What could possibly go wrong? So lightning hits that big, several hundred foot or thousand foot lightning rod in the backyard, heads to earth. Now, if it's an AM, you have some blocking stuff in there. If it's an FM, the tower is grounded. It's all going straight into earth. Earth potential, because earth again has a resistance per foot, you run several hundred thousand amps of current through it, that creates voltage. Potential spikes high. Okay, at some point, it's going to have to go elsewhere to dissipate. It goes outward. And if it happens to go outward and see a nice, easy, cushy path through a transmitter to a bunch of grounds on the AC line, that's where it's going to go. So our goal, every time we do this, is to take that and create that. And I could probably reduce this entire portion of the presentation down to an animation just going like this. Because if you can create that, you will pretty much eliminate lightning failures. Now, you're not going to stop 100%. Because it is a current divider game, which means there is some ratio of that lightning energy still going through our gear, no matter what. And at some point, if the strike is big enough, that percentage is going to have enough potential to cause failures. It can happen. But you can minimize a pile of it, because what we've done here is the surge protector becomes the path between ground out to the AC lines and vice versa, because you will occasionally get a power line surge. Surprisingly enough, even on the end of the line where you've got pretty dirty power, you don't have that many failure-inducing surges coming in from the power line. Not none, but not that many. So something to be aware of. So all we're trying to do, turn that into that. Sounds easy till you're putting it all together in a site that has evolved over several decades with several different pieces of equipment all tied together by different folks in different ways. That's when we start picking up the phone. Call a friend, reach out. I'm happy to answer questions whenever I can. Doesn't even have to be on my gear. I will absolutely do my best to get you the most I can get you out of your existing box. Now, if it's Energionics, we'll have a discussion about cost of operation and various other things, but I'll still help you. You know, it's in my best interest. So getting back to the ground resistance. A lot of people are like, well, we've got good ground here, good ground conductivity. When's the last time you measured it? If you haven't measured it, you don't know, because it does change. Now, the cool thing, Florida has got, surprisingly, absolute terrible ground conductivity because it's so much sand. But you can drive a ground rod anywhere in the state, and at 8 feet, you're in the water table, so it doesn't matter what the ground conductivity is. Up here, you got to go a little further to get into the water table.